May 2, 2024. This is the Room Now podcast. Hi, I'm Dr. Jack Cush, executive editor of RoomNow.com. This week, we've got regulatory stuff, a bunch of lupus reports, things for osteoarthritis and exercise and old people issues. But you know, a lot of the content this week comes from a supplement that came out just recently from Rheumatology, and it's the British Society of Rheumatology abstracts. In the show notes for this podcast at the very end is the link where you can look at those abstracts. It's a wealth of really good information. Congratulations to the BSR for A, putting on a fabulous event every year, and B, publishing them in their journal, Rheumatology. Let's begin at the top with some regulatory news. The FDA this week put out a warning, a drug safety warning, about thiopurine use in pregnancy and its potential association with a rare disorder called intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy, or ICP. Turns out ICP is maybe the most common liver disorder that can occur in pregnancy, affecting about 1 to 2 cases per, you know, 100,000? No, what is it? What's the number? It's 1 to 2 per 1,000. So it's obviously a lot less than 1%. The FDA came across this in patients who are receiving thiopurines for either Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, or lupus. And while thiopurines, meaning 6-MP thioguanine azathioprine, are not approved for those indications, they are often used. But they did find that ICP was being reported in those patients who are taking the thiopurines. And, you know, it's a handful of cases. It's not much. And the FDA, in their drug safety warning, are asking you to report on drug safety events like this. And you do that through MedWatch. And I think that they provide in that safety warning, which we have the link for, the downloads for the forms for that. And I would encourage you, when you see something occurring with a common drug, a new drug especially, that you really don't expect to see, I think you have an obligation to report it to the FDA. It is a bit of a pain, but I think it's really important, because if you don't, who will? Please do so. The FDA also approved this week another adalimumab biosimilar. Actually, this one was already approved. It's the Boehringer Ingelheim product called Ciltizo. It is a biosimilar of Humira. It was previously approved at the usual dose and concentration. They've also now approved the second version of this, again, an interchangeable biosimilar that is different. And now it's the high concentration citrate-free formulation of this adalimumab biosimilar. You remember AbbVie did the same thing with its Humira. The first version was the usual. The second version had a lower volume, higher concentration, was citrate-free. So you have that option now, and that's for all the indications that go along with adalimumab use. The journal Lupus has a few interesting reports on lupus this week. Venous thromboembolic events occur in our lupus patients. In this study from Western Australia, 1,854 SLE patients were compared to over 12,000 controls for what looks like about a 30-year period. And overall, the VTE event rate was, guess, what do you think? How many patients do you have with lupus? How many of them have had PEs or DVTs? Well, their event rate, I think, is spot on, maybe a little higher than what I might expect it. It's 12.8%. You know, that's like 1 in 7, 1 in 8 patients, right? It's sixfold higher than the normal population rate, with a relative risk of 6.6. Risk factors for VTE events you would expect, but you should know. One would be the antiphospholipid antibody, fourfold higher risk. Cirrhosis, right? That's inflammation driving thromboembolic risk, right? That's a 2.7 a hazard ratio. Nephritis, 1.75. Is it nephritis? The proteinuria nephritis that drives the risk? Probably. Maybe the inflammation as well. Low platelets, probably another part of the antiphospholipid syndrome, hazard ratio 1.65. Another report in the same journal from lupus talked about risk of hospitalized infections in a cohort of 202 SLE patients. They found that nearly 45% of them were hospitalized during a prolonged follow-up period. What was the profile? They tend to be younger. They tend to have more active disease, do they not? They tended to have a longer disease duration and higher disease activity scores as measured by SLEDAI, and overall more evidence of organ damage. When you looked at what the hospitalizations were for, it was 61%. Disease activity was the highest. Next was renal disease, infection, drug toxicity being the lowest, 5.6%. Again, the point here is that when lupus patients are hospitalized, it's not always for disease activity. I like to say it's often for medical reasons, infection, heart attack, you know, VTEs, whatever. Again, those can be circuitously related to lupus. But it could also, in this case, disease activity was the number one reason. But it's better to teach that lupus patients get hospitalized for other reasons, not other than lupus, because if they miss that, it could have devastating consequences. And usually, you don't get called in to the consult until it's way too late. A BSR report on very late onset lupus I like. This comes, the lead author was Luisa Viveiros. This is part of David Eisenberg's group. And they talked about very late onset lupus, of which I think they had 15, 20 patients in this cohort study, and that's patients with the lupus onset over age 60. I always wonder, is that really lupus? Is that drug-induced lupus? Is that an older person with arthritis and a positive ANA because they got older? But anyway, I would think that group knows how to diagnose lupus. These older onset lupus patients are less likely to be female compared to younger patients. They have less arthritis, lower disease activity scores. They are either more negative or have lower titers of ANA, DNA, C3, SSA, and SSB. They're also more likely to have Sjogren's syndrome and RA. Is that lupus? Well, lupus does occur in older people. Again, it's a single-center study. The cohort was 845 patients that were followed for a long time. I didn't write it down here. The interesting thing about the very late onset lupus patients is that they had the lowest survival at 20.5 years. Speaking of lupus, you know, we have this week we did our final Room Now Live replay on Tuesday night, where we had three great lectures on rethinking the classification of lupus, on lupus nephritis and biomarkers. And again, it was a really good session. One quote from a podcast we posted out there from this is Dr. Andrea Fava from Hopkins, who talked about biomarkers. He was basically making the point that proteinuria is not a good biomarker. It's incredibly unreliable. He said 50% of patients with lupus nephritis are asymptomatic, and you're not going to know it, and they're not going to have proteinuria. So you have to have some degree of kidney damage before you get the proteinuria, and proteinuria does not correlate with intrarenal activity. But he did show that the urinary biomarkers, IL-16 and CD163 were uniquely and very strongly associated with renal disease activity, pathology, activity score, etc. You might want to listen to that podcast. It's out there for your listening. The Journal of Rheumatology published a report this week on ANCA-associated vasculitis and associated diffuse alveolar hemorrhage syndrome. I hate this occurrence. It has a high mortality rate. It's a dramatic presentation. These people do badly if you don't diagnose it early. And in this study of 234 patients where they found 36% who had this complication, predictors of DAH, diffuse alveolar hemorrhage, was age, goes up with age. Platelet count, as platelet counts go down, it goes up a little bit, the risk. Sed rate, higher sed rates, higher risk. And lower hemoglobins, higher risk. And hematuria, almost a fourfold increased risk. Again, early diagnosis of this in vasculitis patients and in lupus can be life-saving. The Journal of Rheumatology this week also talked about GCA patients, a cohort of 530 patients, and they looked at the issue of relapse. Relapse is common. in GCA because you're always, you know, messing with the steroid dose and trying to minimize that and never quite knowing when or how to do it. And this is something we all struggle with. But relapses are seen in 46% of patients. But they also wanted to look specifically at severe relapses. Severe relapses were relapses that resulted in basically ischemic tissue impairment, and that could lead to CVA or aortic events and all, you know. But this was less common, only 3% of cases. Severe relapses were more likely at when they were younger at diagnosis. GCA, younger at diagnosis, what is that, 59? Patients who had more limb claudication, those who had fewer cranial symptoms at presentation. But interestingly, even though this subset has severe relapses with serious consequences, they did not have a higher mortality than those that did not have severe relapses. So that's sort of good news. A Danish registry study, and I think I reported this one time before, and it's a head-scratcher for me, but I think we have to deal with this and rectify it, understand it. Why is it? And this is Danish registry data. They've got great records, and they link them up, and they come up, I think, with pretty accurate data. But again, registry data is hypothesis-generating data. It is not proof of principle. Now, again, proof of principle requires a well-designed trial that you may never get. And that's why there is a value to registry studies like this. What's the point? You want me to get to that? They show a positive correlation between maternal autoimmune disease and the future development of cancer in the child offspring. What? Yes, autoimmune disease in the mother has a 25% increased risk of all childhood cancers. ALL, the odds ratio is 1.52. These are significant numbers. Burkitt's lymphoma, 2.69. Neurological tumors, 1.45. These numbers were a notch higher if the maternal case was one with rheumatoid arthritis, where the all cancer risk was not 1.25, but instead was 2.1. So this is worrisome. I think we have to understand this risk. I think it behooves us to understand that control of inflammation and disease activity is paramount, one, to making a healthy baby that will result in a live birth, but also paramount to making to a healthy baby that won't have future complications like a higher risk of infection or a malignancy or God knows what other complications could ensue. A very important report this week in JAMA Dermatology. Wait a second, I think I skipped one. Another report from the British Society of Rheumatology Abstracts, led by Miriam Addis. This is a UK early inflammatory arthritis cohort where they did an audit of 20,000 patients and that were taking all kinds of medicines, 12,000 of whom were on methotrexate, 5,000 were on other non-methotrexate conventional DMARDs, 2,500 on no DMARDs. And the serious infection rate was 3.19 or 3.2 per 100 patient years. The death rate was 0.1 per 100 patient years or 1 per 1,000. Let's reflect on this first for a second. What is the risk of a serious infection in an RA population? Studies by Doran from the Mayo Clinic says 3 to 9 per 100 patient years in the pre-biologic era. All the biologics that have come out are generally, you know, 4, 5, 6, you know, sometimes a little lower. You want to see a really low serious infection rate, look at early RA patients. That's who we're looking at here. This is an early inflammatory arthritis cohort. So it's 3 per 100 patient years, and it's 1 per 1,000 for death. That's great. All the usual predictors for SIE, serious infections, are in play. Age, smoking, disease activity, and high HAQ. For every 1 unit increase in DAS score, you have an 8% increased risk of serious infection. That's pretty similar to what Paul Emery published a number of years ago. I want to talk about this JAMA Derm report about methotrexate not increasing the risk of ILD. The cohort under study are patients with dermatomyositis. What we do know is that interstitial lung disease is a complication of dermatomyositis in up to 23% of patients, and that methotrexate is often used to treat this disorder. What about methotrexate and its association with lung disease? Well, you know, it's rare, right? Because methotrexate causes a hypersensitivity pneumonitis in 0.3% in this paper. I think it's even less than that, unless if you use folic acid, in my opinion. And the risk of methotrexate patients developing, and this is an RA, interstitial lung disease, is 11% in this report. But is that really from methotrexate, or is it in RA patients in whom 11% or more will get ILD? I think it's more the latter. Anyway, from their cohort, they found 63 patients with dermatomyositis, 163, I think it was, and a third were on methotrexate, and two-thirds were not. The study was powered to detect a 13% difference in the groups as far as developing future ILD, and there was no difference. If you were exposed to methotrexate, the risk of, and again, remember, the historic risk of ILD in dermatomyositis, 28%. Probably about 15 to 30% in RA. In this DM population exposed to methotrexate, it was 17%. Not exposed to methotrexate, it was 16%. No association, despite the worries, fears, and conniptions of your pulmonary colleagues. So again, I think that this is an important finding, one that you can pull out of your hat and show to your colleagues who are worried about this association between methotrexate and ILD. Interestingly, those who were treated with methotrexate were less likely to develop a malignancy that was presumed to be related to the dermatomyositis. And these patients also were more likely to receive rituximab. So I hope you find that interesting. I certainly did. The last report comes from JAMA Network Open, where it tells us about the risk of developing knee osteoarthritis with weight-bearing exercises. This doesn't seem all that interesting, except they're looking at it from the standpoint of what's the role of lower limb muscle mass. And they basically say lower limb muscle mass, when you don't have enough of it, augments your risk. So they had a cohort. What's the number? It's pretty large. Follow-up was, it's the Rotterdam study is the name of it. It's a sub-analysis of that. Included 5,003 patients, adults over the age of 45, who did not have incident osteoarthritis going in. And they followed them serially with x-rays, exams. They did DEXA scans to assess muscle mass, and they assessed the levels of exercise. Higher weight-bearing activity was associated with an increased risk of knee OA. That's not that surprising, although you'd like to see that number go down. But they found out that most of it was, and they showed that non-weight-bearing activity was not associated with a risk of OA, right? But they found that the patients who had the association were largely those who were in the lowest tertile of muscle mass. So now the risk that was significant between weight-bearing activity at 1.22 now went up to 1.53 when it was only the lower tertile. And it was not for the middle and the higher muscle mass tertiles. So I think this says a lot. If you're going to recommend better outcomes for your knee OA patients before they get it, as they have it, make sure they have enough of a lower muscle mass to accommodate the exercise and to protect the joint from the weight-bearing aspect of that, which leads to pounding, which leads to, as you would imagine, repetitive stress on cartilage, etc. That's it for this week and the podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. Go to the citation, to the this particular report on the website to find the citations, including that great long list of BSR 2024 abstracts. Tune in next week to the Room Now podcast. Take care.